Welcome to another episode of Cosmic Echo, a Tailor podcast. This podcast applies a scientific viewpoint on the strange, bizarre phenomenon that happens in our lives when we sleep in altered states. In this episode, we speak with Steve Andrews, otherwise known as the Bard of Ely, and is a man of many talents. He's a writer, author, journalist, singer, songwriter, public speaker, poet, and naturalist. He also has written another books on the subject of plants, including Herbs of the Northern Shaman and Herbs of the Sun, Moon, and Planet. He also has produced a number of music videos and songs that include themes about environmental activism. His newest song extends past plants and is about the plastics in the ocean and bringing attention to it. In this episode, we speak with Steve about his work with plants, how he fell in love with plants, and what his current passions are. So without further ado, let's get to the interview.
So, Steve, yeah, just go ahead, if you don't mind, introduce yourself and give us a little bit of background on who you are and your work.
Okay, will do. Well, hi, everyone. My name is Steve Andrews. I'm also known as the Bard of Ely. That's E-L-Y, Ely, and not Eli. And I'm known as Green Bard and Green Beard. The last name because I've got a green beard. And the Bard of Ely, I better explain that. I used to write for a magazine called Big Issue. Some of you may have heard of that. It's a magazine for homeless people that's sold in the UK. Okay. And it's like it's really famous in the UK because like every city has Big Issue sellers. And anyway, I used to have a column in that back in 1998. And the editorial team knew that I was a singer-songwriter and a poet because they'd sometimes reviewed my stuff. So they used to start my, you know, whatever I was writing about with the Bard of Ely does, or, you know, whatever I was looking at. Bard of Ely goes along to check out. Bard. So I thought, okay, so they're calling me Bard of Ely. And so that's where the name came from. And it was, it sort of appealed to my sense of humor as well. Because I was living on this vast council estate. And the only thing this council estate is known for, really, is Shaking Stevens, the rock star who happened to come from there. But, it, you know, it's a pretty sort of rough, you know, working class estate. And it's okay. Not the sort of place you would expect a bard to come from. But I thought, well, I've done it. I'm the Bard of Ely. And the title has stuck. And so, I use that as well. I think it's easy to remember as well, you know. And some people say, I've even heard people say, well, what is a bard?
What is a bard?
Say, well, you know, a bard is a poet, a minstrel, a singer, a songwriter, a musician, a performer. All these things are loosely a bard. And it's very much also in the sort of Celtic tradition because you have what we call in Wales Eisteddfods, and which is a celebration of music, poetry. And the people who would, you know, read out a poem or do something like this would be a bard. And so, you know, I'm a Bard of Ely. I'm also the principal bard of the Loyal Arthurian War Band, Stonehenge Grove.
That's a good one. Wow.
But I am that. And
what's a principal bard?
The main bard. I am.
Oh, okay.
And this is to do with, I don't know whether you heard of this guy, King Arthur Uther Pendragon.
Okay.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
King Arthur.
he's a druid leader, and, you know, he reckons he is the reincarnation of the spirit of King Arthur.
Oh,
now,
okay,
some people say, well, King Arthur never existed. But you know, whether he did or whether he didn't, this guy is doing it, is being King Arthur. And he's very well known in the media, you know, for many years. He's been on many TV programs, been the front page of the Guardian newspaper, Big Breakfast Show. You know, basically, you know, you name it, he's been there. And he's saying he's King Arthur. He's got a sword, Excalibur. He looks the part as well. He's got a big beard. He's got long hair. He's got like a circlet around his head. He's got a big robe. And so I am actually a knighted member of his druid order.
Interesting.
So I'm called, I'm a quest knight. So you've got like shield knights who are entitled to carry a shield if they so wish. For example, somebody who reckoned that he was, say, king, say, Sir Lancelot or Sir Kay, one of the famous knights, then they could have a shield. So they'd be a shield knight. A quest knight is somebody who doesn't claim to know like who they were, but they basically agree with Arthur's whole idea, what he's trying to do.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, well, I'm like that, and I regard my life as a quest anyway. I'm always looking to do something.
Yeah.
So I accepted the knighthood of quest knight of the Loyal Arthurian Warband.
Wow.
And Arthur is really famous for Stonehenge for a whole load of different campaigns there. One of the main ones being getting it open to the public for the summer solstice. And years back, he used to get arrested every year for breaking what was called the exclusion zone. The police used to say people cannot go to summer solstice at Stonehenge. And if you were walking on the road, they would call it a procession. And so you could say, well, what is a procession? Is one person a procession? Two people? How many people is it? Anyway, they would often arrest him, and then he would be in the local cells for the night. And this went on for a number of years, but then finally there was a court case in which he took Wiltshire Constabulary to court for wrongful arrest and imprisonment. And he was awarded, I think it was £2,000 out of court settlement. And then after that, they changed the rules a bit and they let people in. So basically, Arthur, in many people's minds, is the guy that got it together to get people allowed to come in for summer solstice at Stonehenge. And but he's been doing all sorts of stuff. But basically, he is fighting for truth, honor, and justice, which he's calling the ancient virtues. And if you were sworn, you know, into his order, then you swear to uphold the ancient virtues of truth, honor, and justice. And I thought, you know, that's a good thing to do. So that's what I swore to when I became a knight.
Nice.
I can actually tell you that there's some famous people are also in the order. John Lydon, Johnny Rotten, he's been under the sword. And Ozzy Osbourne is also, and Jack Osbourne. So they met with Arthur. And it's basically a spreading movement. So anyway, via that, I became the principal bard of the Stonehenge Grove. And I was there this summer solstice. And I have a song called King Arthur's Coming. And I did this song at the dawn ceremony at the Healstone of the circle there. So that was something, you know, I just did this summer. But I'm supposed to be telling you, like, who I am.
That's very interesting, man.
Okay, yeah. So I'm a bard, singer-songwriter, I'm a poet. I'm an author. I'm an author of a number of books, and I've got, like, books on... I call them herbals, but they're basically books on herbs. I've got Herbs of the Northern Shaman, A Guide to Mind-Altering Plants of the Northern Hemisphere. And this book has been out twice. It was first out on Loom Panics Unlimited, which is an American publisher. You may have heard of Loom Panics.
No, I personally haven't. But...
Oh, okay. Well, they used to publish a lot of stuff, pretty much sort of fringe stuff. Then it's come out again now on Moon Books, and the Moon Books version is much better because it's in the original one, the American one, was black and white, but the Moon Books one is in full color. So I've got additional species of herb that I've added to it, and there's new text, color photos. And
seems like color would be important for herbalism as well, you know, showing the colors of plants and things like that.
Yeah, that's right, because it helps you to identify them. And I mean, I'm very much about color anyway. But as you've already heard, I've got like a green beard. And I think some people would think I'm a very colorful type of person. So I like color. You know, I mean, color to me is the world is colorful. You know, you go out into nature, you've got colorful flowers and butterflies and colorful birds. And it's what it's about, you know, in a blue sky and so green grass, all these things that we like are all colourful. So to me, the more color that's out there, you know, the better, you know. So I like a bit of color in my books. And that was my first book. And I've got another book by the same company, Pagan Portals, Herbs of the Sun, Moon, and Planets.
Yeah.
And I usually, you know, explain that one a bit because people can say, well, that's a bit weird. How can you have herbs on the sun and the moon and on the planet? As we know, there aren't any. Maybe there are some on Mars, but we haven't, you know, sort of discovered them really yet. It doesn't actually mean that the herbs grow on these planets. What it's about is that the ancient herbalists had a system whereby they were sort of combining herbalism with astrology. So they were having a look at what the deities of like Rome and Greece, what these deities ruled over. So, for example, they'd say Mars was the god of war. So they'd look at the characteristics of war, something aggression and maybe violence and blood and anything like that. So they'd find a herb that had some of these characteristics. And I always say that the dragon tree is absolutely ideal. It's a dragon tree. It's got big spiky leaves, like you call them lance-shaped or sword-shaped leaves. And if you cut it, the resin sort of bleeds a red resin, so they call that a dragon's blood. So that's pretty violent. It's got to do with blood and red. And also the tree, it'll grow in very sort of inhospitable areas. It'll grow like on rocky ground and it stands up, you know, to its environment. It's got red berries as well. So you've got a lot of red there. You've got the spikiness. And so that's a herb of Mars. And then we've got herbs of Venus. It's like, for example, like Venus was known as the goddess of love, yeah? So the rose is a symbol of love. And not surprisingly, the rose was chosen as a herb of Venus. Then we've got some of the others a bit more... more interesting in a way. Mercury was the messenger of the gods, very much about communication. So most of the herbs that you find ruled by Mercury are herbs which really communicate in some way. So they may have like a strong scent and interesting, you know, foliage, flowers, whatever. They make a big impression on you. So you say, oh, hey, this herb really is communicating to me. So then that would be the reason why they would go under Mercury. And what else have we got? We got Saturn and Jupiter. Jupiter, which of course is a gas giant. As a planet, we know it is a gas giant. Gas tends to expand. Gas is not something solid. So one of the characteristics of Jupiter is expansion. So we find quite a lot of trees which are chosen to be herbs of Jupiter because they expand out. You know, you go underneath a tree and you can see all the branches above you. And the pine tree is an example of that. And also the lime tree. And the lime tree is interesting as well because it's also in my Herbs of the Northern Shaman because it has a sort of relaxant properties. It makes a very, if you make a tea out of it, which is very popular, it tends to relax you. It's a good tea to chill out to. Or with, rather, and the lime tree at one point, it was even believed that, like, if you were an epileptic and you went and rested under a lime tree, it would heal you of your problems. So that was how powerful the lime tree was once believed to be. But it's today it's a very popular tree for herbal teas, and certainly where I live in Portugal, also in Spain. You can go in any supermarket and you can buy lime flower tea bags. And because it's under Jupiter, because it's a tree, its branches expand out. And then Saturn was considered to be with more to do with old age and death even. And so lots of the herbs under Saturn are poisonous plants. The hemlock is regarded as a herb of Saturn. And the henbane and the deadly nightshade. So these very poisonous herbs are usually under Saturn. And so it's, if you like, it's the grim reaper of the planets. So basically this is what it's all. Oh, and the sun. I forgot the sun. How could I forget the sun? The sun being the main one. The sun is regarded as the life giver and the source of all light. And a herb of the sun could have like yellow rays to its flower. The sunflower is ruled by the sun and is a perfect example of a solar disk with a round part of it and the yellow petals all around. So the sunflower is a herb of the sun. Also, the St. John's wort, and also there's also St. John's wort, however you want to say it, that's a herb of the sun. And again, we have the golden yellow petals in like a star-like formation. And of course, the sun is a star. And so it's very appropriate that the St. John's wort flower is like a little golden star. And it lifts your spirits. As I'm sure you know, St. John's wort is used as an antidepressant. So again, it's life-affirming. It's golden, it's sunny looking, and so yeah, they put that one under the herbs of the sun. If we go to the herbs of the moon, and I'd forgotten the moon is to do with controlling water, controlling the tides, which is what the moon does. So anything to do with water may be to do with the moon. So the water lily is a prime candidate. The water lily grows in water, but not only that, it's got rounded leaves like a full moon. So that they said, okay, the water lily is definitely a herb of the moon. Some of the others which take a bit more understanding and explaining, like the wild lettuce is a herb of the moon. And that's because if you cut it, the sap that it bleeds, like a latex, is white. So anything which is white or silvery, they thought, okay, that's to do with the moon. And that's another of the herbs, which is also in my Herbs of the Northern Shaman. In this case, because the lettuce has quite strong sedative properties, tranquilizing properties, and you can make a lettuce opium out of it, out of the sap. If you dry this white sap off, it goes like dark, like opium. And it's even being used to adulterate like proper opium. You put, you know, some lettuce opium in with it as well, you make more of it. And it's been sold in sort of head shops and, you know, for many years, you could buy like a little sachet of dried lettuce leaves. And I don't know if it's legal now because they keep changing the rules with, you know, what's legal and what isn't. But it used to be like a legal high.
Interesting.
So, you know, and that's the wild lettuce, which is, of course, the ancestor of the cultivated lettuce. But the cultivated lettuce, again, would be regarded as a herb of the moon. Because, again, if you cut a, you know, an ordinary lettuce we eat, you see the sap is white. So they say, okay, this is white like the moon. And so that's like, I think I've given you an explanation of what all that's about.
Yeah, definitely.
I've got a new book which isn't out yet, but pictures of it. Well, I've got a copy of it here, but it's not supposed to be out till next April. So this is Herbs of the Southern Shaman. And what I've done in that is in the Herbs of the Northern Shaman, obviously I've looked at herbs that grow in the Northern Hemisphere. And I've used the word shaman sort of loosely, that if the herbs affect the mental state in some way, I thought, okay, they can go in this book. So some of the herbs are sort of hallucinogens, psychedelic herbs, things like morning glory, magic mushrooms, peyote, things like that. But also things which are like sedative, tranquilizing properties, as I said, wild lettuce, the lime tree, the opium poppy. And then I've got also ones which are like St. John's wort, which is an antidepressant, and herbs which are stimulants as well. So all these different herbs, if they affect the mind, then they're sort of candidates for my book. So anyway, so I've done Herbs of the Northern Shaman, and then I thought, okay, well, I better do one for the South as well. So that was a little tricky in working out exactly what is the South, because you've got like the Southern states of America. So is this the South or is this in the North America? You see what I mean? You've got Southern states in North America. But I thought, okay, well, I'll call that Southern. And then Central America, Mexico, has got a fantastic number of plants with properties over the mind, and plants which have been used by, you know, shamans there and by tribal shamans. For example, like the Aztecs and the Mayans would have used various plants, including like the morning glory, which is a well-known garden flower and herb, which contains lysergic acid amide in the seeds. And so I sort of go southern states, Mexico, Central America, South America, South Africa, Australia, the south of the globe, for the herbs included in this book. And the idea was it was just a follow on for the northern ones. So, but it's not out yet. If we had a video link here, I would be able to show you it, but I can't do that. But I've got it in front of me here.
So I just wanted to get a little bit of background about you. I know you introduced yourself at the beginning there, but can you tell us a little bit about how you got into this? Because it sounds like you have a ton of knowledge about medicinal plants, and also it sounds like astrology and Celtic traditions. But I'm interested how you got into learning about plants and kind of why are you so interested in this, and then how, what's your interest zoning into, like what are you most interested when it comes to plants?
Okay, well, that's a fantastic question, and I'll try and answer. I think really for me, my interests in plants started when I was a little boy, because it wasn't just plants, it was nature, it was everything that was alive, because when I was about maybe 4 or 5, I started to find things outside in the garden that absolutely fascinated me. So I found insects, and I found, different flowers and all these things. And then, to me, they were just amazing. And like things like slugs and snails and worms and all the creepy crawly creatures and the birds and the butterflies and all this stuff was just all like amazing. And so I used to ask my mum and dad what things were, and then they'd get me little books. So for me, my passion in life, by the age of 5, was finding out what all these creatures and flowers and things are. And I had like a lot of books then. And as I grew older, I just got more books. So I started to find out more. I used to go out a lot of the time just looking in the countryside for things, and I was lucky, but my father used to take the family out in the car, and we used to go out to countryside locations. So maybe we'd go to a lake, or we'd go to a forest, or maybe some sand dunes or a beach or wherever. And I remember like my mother used to think that, I was pretty strange on the beach, because like most children, they go to the beach, they want to go in the sea, like swimming, paddling. I used to take my Wellington boots, my rubber boots, and I didn't go. I'd go in the rock pools looking for things in the rock pools. So if it was a river mouse, I'd be wading about in the mud looking for stuff. Because that to me was what was interesting. Like, what is here? What living things can I find here? And like I said, it wasn't just the animals. It was also all the plants. So, and as I became older, I started to learn about the plants are all really important for maybe the animals. For example, a butterfly caterpillar needs a specific type of a food plant for that caterpillar. We have this example with the monarch butterfly, which I happen to be rearing here at the moment. I let some out today. And the monarch butterfly, the caterpillars can only eat milkweeds. So, we need to know what plants feed, what creature. So I started to learn all that stuff. And I started to learn that plants have properties as well. And in fact, the plant I just mentioned, the milkweed, does. And you may well know that the milkweed, because it has toxins in it, it's a poisonous plant. The monarch butterfly caterpillar absorbs that, and then that makes the caterpillar poisonous and having a bad taste, which is a defense for anything which would be a predator. And so then it has warning colors. And I learned about all this as a kid, that warning colors means like bright colors, contrasting colors. So a monarch butterfly has the reddish orange and the black on the wings, and the caterpillars are striped. And then you have like the ladybird, or ladybug as you call it in America, with like a red a red wing case with black spots on it and other variations. And these are all warning colors. And it's basically meaning like, don't eat me because I'm poisonous or I make you sick. And usually the creature has absorbed the poisons and something else which it eats. And so I started to learn about these things. And then, of course, I've always liked food, you know. And so, my mum used to make, like, mint sauce to go with the lamb. We had, like, Sunday roast and we had lamb to eat. We'd have mint sauce. So I found, like, well, what's mint? Oh, it's a herb, you know, it's a plant we grow in the garden. And I used to help my grandfather a lot with his allotment where he grew his vegetables, and also my father's. And they had all sorts of plants. They had like rhubarb, which is a herb, and sage and thyme. And so I started to learn, you know, about the herbs as a little kid. And they were very wonderful because, as I'm sure you know, like you can get like a wonderful a scent, a perfume from a herb. You crush it up a bit in your hands and inhale that smell, and it's a wonderful smell. You know, mint will do it, or sage will do it, and thyme, and those ones I just mentioned. And other ones like fennel, sort of like a nice little aniseed smell to it. And they've all got different smells. And that's very important because it sort of identifies them. And it's something that, like, if I'm... I've done guided walks, you know, and I'm, you know, telling people about plants you can find and stuff. And for me, it's very important to know how to identify something. And it's so important because a herb I mentioned earlier, which is a herb of Saturn, is hemlock. And hemlock's deadly poisonous. So you need to know we don't eat that one, yeah? But then there's another herb quite similar to it, which would be fine. You could eat. So you really need to know what you can eat and what you can't. And just getting back to the subject of the shamans, the tribal shamans, to me, again, what's happened here is you had people, you know, through however long these people have been alive, wherever they've been, people have been experimenting to find out, what does this plant do? What can we do with this plant? If I eat this, what will happen? And people have found out at various stages in their history, if we take this plant, it produces, you know, visions, or maybe it just sends me to sleep, or maybe it poisons me and I die. In which case, people say, "Well, we don't eat that one again," you know. So people have been learning about the properties of herbs for a very long time, and then they, in a tribal situation, they hand down the wisdom that they've garnered through time to, you know, their successors, and so that people get to learn about what this herb does and what another herb will do. And this has always been, like, exceedingly important in all tribal societies. And I think in the modern sort of system we live under, lots of people are losing touch with things like this. So unless that they're being told, you know, they don't really know, and even then they don't know. You know, we have all this talk about fake news and stuff. People don't even know whether something they're told is true or false or whatever. But if you, in a tribal situation, it's better because you know you can trust your elders, you know you can trust the shaman, because these people will really know what they're on about because they've had to learn that stuff, and they know that their ancestors also learned that and passed the information down. And I think, you know, with modern people in the civilizations we're living in, it's very good that people are connecting with nature and with the wild in any way. And this is where I think, like, foraging for wild food is really important. There's a lot of people doing that more. And this is important, you know. It's important to be able to know if you go out into the wild, into the countryside, what plants, what fruits, what toadstools, mushrooms you can gather there that you can eat, and what ones you don't eat. And this is the basics, you know, of life. And if you think about it, I'm just thinking, like, you know, we're supposed to be Homo sapiens, you know, the wise, but just about any animal is far wiser than we are because they know what they can eat and what they can't eat. They all eat what they need, whereas people often haven't a clue, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important, you know, for us to be learning about anything that's to do with nature. and also to try and remember that we are part of nature. And all of this, like I said, it started when I was a little boy. So if you like, that loosely, that's when my interest in plants came about. And then from that, my interest in herbs. And then to explain about maybe like the shamanic herbs and things in my teens, yes, I admit it. I started, you know, I became part of the hippie generation, the 60s flower children or whatever you want to call the alternative society. And I started to experiment with various herbal substances. And so, yes, I have taken various, you know, psychedelic plants, and I've tried these things. So I know what they do and I know how powerful they are. And that was like an additional part of my knowledge about herbs. Like, for example, say when I was an 8 or 10 year old boy, I might know that this herb has got a very nice smell and you can flavor foods with it, or maybe even that it's good for sore throats or something like that. Maybe when I was 16, I found out if you take this herb, you can have a trip, you know, it's a hallucinogenic plant. So these are other properties that the plants have. And for me, every single plant has got properties. They may even have properties we don't know, but they've still got properties. And everything is so important in the ecosystem of the whole planet, you know. And so everything is also, it may be like important to another species. Like I was saying earlier, like the milkweed is vitally important to the monarch butterfly. And what's gone wrong often is that people don't realize this. So they think, oh, we don't want that. That's a weed, get rid of that. We don't like that. And then that causes a really bad knock-on effect, because something else which depends on it hasn't got its food source there. And then maybe something else again needs to feed on that, and it can't because it's the numbers are down. So all these things are, you know, things that we should think about and know about.
It sounds like you've always been in love with plants since a young age. Did your experience on certain plants, you know, through the psychedelic experience, have anything to do with like how you perceived plants in a different way, or did it change anything in you that made you think of plants in an alternate way that you haven't thought of before?
Well, I think the answer to that is a big yes, because if you've taken magic mushrooms or morning glory, or, you know, any of these things which produce a psychedelic state of a vision, a hallucinogenic state, whatever you want to call it, it's so different to your normal reality that your perception has changed so radically that you're going to think, wow, you know, what's all this going on? You know, it's something, it's so powerful, especially, of course, like LSD. Like if you take an LSD, then you know, you're not going to forget that. That's like a life-changing experience. And so I think like all these herbal sources of substances like that they make a very powerful impression on you, and which is why, of course, they're also thought of as plant teachers. And you have so many. You have like, I'm just thinking like peyote and ayahuasca and these plants are regarded as not just, you know, a plant with a property, but almost like a living spirit, like a deity, something which can teach people. And there are so many plants that are like that. And also something which has interested me is that DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is a very powerful substance, is in so many plants all around the planet. And you know, I mean, it may be a class A drug, but in nature, it's supplied anyway, you know. And to me, this has always been something which is crazy, is that like human laws try to say that these things are, you know, to be forbidden us, you know, that they're, that's a class A drug, you can't have that. But in nature, these things are supplied all over the planet. So you wonder, well, why is this? Why have we got psilocybin containing mushrooms like all over the planet, or most of the planet, maybe not the Arctic regions, but you know what I mean. Most places you've got mushrooms which contain psilocybin. And you've got all these sort of like lysergic acid amide. You know, it's in Morning Glories, and it's also in the Hawaiian Baby Woodrose. And there are so many plant sources that have got these substances in, which definitely affect the mind in a big way. And like I said, you know, we do know that the past cultures, you know, people like the Aztecs and the Mayans and also the ancient Egyptians, that these people all used these herbal substances, and they were important to their priesthoods, and they were important to their shamans, and they were used. Maybe we don't know exactly how they used them or what they, you know, what they made of it all, but what we do know is that they did use them, and that they were an important part of their culture at the time. And it's actually the culture which we live in is a bit strange, because all these past cultures were saying, well, it's okay, you know, for people to be using these things. But the current culture is saying, oh, no, you can't do that. You can drink alcohol, that's okay, which is bad for you. But any of these other things, no, you mustn't do that. So it's a very controlling culture we're in.
Definitely. And, do you have any view on why that is? Like why culture tends to think that alcohol is maybe a positive thing, or at least something that we can do to alter our minds, but to stay away from plants?
I think it's because the plants open you up to so many different ways of seeing, and so many different ways of seeing is a good way of explaining it. Like if you take a plant which is a hallucinogenic plant, then it's giving you like a whole new worldview. Even if it's just something that you take it and you see like all the colors become brighter, or, you know, just think just standard things like that. You think, oh, wow, you know, I didn't know it was like this, but if I take this, it becomes like that. So it's a different perception which the plants give you. And this culture sort of works on trying to keep everybody within a box. You know, this is what you do. This is how we do things. This is what you are required to do. These are the laws that you must live under. We are the people that know best. We are the people that, you know, that will tell you what to do, and you must listen to what we say because we know. All this sort of culture doesn't really want people finding out different things or anything outside what they're telling you. And this was really the problem with, if you like, the 60s generation, the alternative, the flower power culture, is that the younger people then were taking all these mind-expanding things and experimenting, and they were sort of saying, well, maybe we don't agree with the way everything is going on. Maybe we don't agree with the Vietnam War. Maybe we don't want all this materialism that you're pushing on us. Maybe we want to go to India and study under a guru or something. So all this change came about, and it came about with plants which were opening up people to different possibilities and perceptions, I think.
Yeah, I noticed that you're in Portugal, is that correct?
I'm in Portugal, yeah.
Yeah, I've recently heard about some drug reform changes happening in Portugal, and I was just wondering if you had any ideas about that, or your perceptions of how it's taking place and if it's helping or changing the discussion on drugs in general there.
I think over here, the drug situation is much better, shall I say, than the UK. You don't really have like a drug problem here. You know, I mean, obviously like drugs exist, but you don't get people. You get some, but you don't get anywhere near the amount of people with drug problems that you would have, say, in the UK and probably in America.
Well, getting back into plants, I'm really interested in your view on plant consciousness. I know that a lot of people talk about that now as plants having consciousness. And if you watch any videos on plants sped up, you can obviously see that there's some more advanced things happening and taking place than we generally see. It seems like they're a little bit slower than people and animals, but what's your perspective on plant consciousness? And
well, I think plant consciousness, to me, a plant would have some form of consciousness because it's in the living thing. I think like every living thing has consciousness. you know, again, it's impossible for us to say what the consciousness that it has is. It's maybe it's impossible for us to experience it, but I think that we can more or less come to the conclusion that if it's alive, it's got some form of consciousness. It has perceptions, and because we think of like animal, I mean, this is like a massive subject because some yeah. people like to think that animals don't have consciousness, animals don't feel, and animals. And so, but this really just gives them a justification of being able to treat animals, you know, however they wish. They can say, oh, it's just an animal, it doesn't have any feeling, and it doesn't matter if we, you know, we hit it about or whatever, that's okay. But if they start to think, well, actually, the animal has the same sort of range of feelings that we have, then it changes matters, yeah?
Yeah, now, definitely.
It's a bit, I think, like the term is speciesism. You know, we have speciesism in a lot of people suffer from speciesism. So we say humans are much better. Humans are Homo sapiens. We're wise. We know what's right. But at the same time, we've made a terrible mess of the planet, but we're still wise. And we can sort it out. But then you look at, you know, the efforts of people trying to sort it out, and it often doesn't really, you know, make that much difference, or it may even make things worse. So maybe we can say, well, we're not so wise, but we still like to think, oh, we're better than all these other animals. We can do what we like. They're just animals. Or as I said earlier with plants, oh, this is just a weed. We don't need these weeds. We don't even like them. We're going to get rid of them. But they don't actually know, like, do the weeds have a consciousness? What do the weeds think about it? What do the animals think about it? And I like to think that, I admit, okay, it's what I like to think, so I don't necessarily know, but I do know that animals can think and animals have feelings. And anybody, if you keep dogs or cats or, you know, you can see that these animals definitely have feelings. They have preferences and things they like and things they don't like. And they think like we do, you know. So what our plant thinks, okay, we don't know. And I think we could say that a plant is maybe moving on a different sort of time frame to us. You can actually see that. And maybe a plant takes a really long time to grow. I'm just thinking actually of a plant I mentioned earlier, the dragon tree. Dragon tree can take like 10 years of real time to get about a meter high. The dragon tree can live for thousands of years. There's one in Tenerife where I used to live, which is called the Drago Millenario, and it's supposed to be like a 1,000-year-old dragon tree. And it may be older, you know, we don't exactly know, but, you know, however old it is, it's a very old tree, and it's taken a very long time to get to the size it's in. So what I'm trying to say is, like a plant can take a long time to do something, or a plant can actually do stuff quick. You know, there's some plants, you plant them and the seed germinates, and maybe a day later, you know, it's maybe, you know, 4 or 5 inches high, and then it carries on growing quickly. So some stuff, it'll take a long time to germinate and it grows slowly. Some stuff grows fast. And some stuff, you know, if you've got a plant, it'll move towards the light quickly, and some stuff won't move so quickly. So it's all, but you can see it moving. That's what I'm saying. Like all plants, especially if you do like a time-lapse photography or something, you can actually film, you know, the motion of a plant. And so we know that plants move. And we can also say that plants do react to things. You know, we know that plants react to things that they don't like. Then they all have like, ways of expressing this in different ways to we do, but that they're still expressing things. And so if you, I mean, I'm a gardener and I look after plants and I love plants. So if I see a plant and I look to it and I say, how is this plant doing? And I might think this plant's not doing that well. It's looking as if it could do with a bit more water, or maybe it could do with a bit more light, which are essentials for the plant. And so the plant is expressing something which I can see. So, but you know, how much feeling is in there? I don't know. Like if I was a plant and I'd been starved of water and I haven't got much light coming on me, am I going, oh gosh, oh, I feel terrible. Oh, I feel so ill. I don't know if I'm going to should ever live much longer. Like, you know, do I do that? Or do I just have almost like physical things which are showing in me that communicate to the rest of the world? But whatever the situation is, plants communicate in a big way. And plants communicate to each other. And there's a lot of stuff which has sort of been looked at about the roots of plants and the root hairs and the relationship they have to the other plants. And then also you have then of the fungi. And the fungi are just incredible. I mean, some fungi, the what they call the mycelium, which is under the soil, under the compost, that can stretch for, you know, a vast distance. And so maybe you see just like one mushroom and you think, oh, well, that's very, very pretty or whatever you think about it. But you haven't really got any idea of how big the rest of it is underneath the soil. And all of that is like a really complicated system of little threads which is running through the compost. And so you have all this... how to describe it, sort of complicated system of plants linking with other plants and depending on other plants and the conditions of the soil and the dampness of the soil and the amount of heat that the soil has got and all this different stuff all makes up sort of how well the organisms living in that are going to be able to do. And to me, like all of nature is an incredible communication system as well as everything else. It's all communicating. And if you look at flowers are communicating. They're communicating to bees and to butterflies. And many flowers have evolved and, you know, to have really specialized flowers, especially for attracting specific types of insect or maybe even birds, for example, like hummingbirds pollinate some types of flower. So you can have like all this incredible variation, and all of it works by some form of communication.
That makes sense, yeah. Sounds like in your perspective, you know, consciousness is kind of in everything as well, just not just in plants.
Yeah, I think I would say that if you ask me, do I believe in God? I do not believe in the Bible God. I don't believe in, you know, this guy up in heaven with, you know, big beard that makes all these rules and regulations for us poor sinners down here. I don't believe that. But I do believe that there is a sort of a spirit which runs through everything. If you like, a consciousness of sorts, something which is animating life. I think I would say I do sort of tend to believe that.
And yeah, definitely. It sounds like it.
I can see that in everywhere I go, I can see all forms of life there. Maybe not so much within human habitations. Maybe, you know, you can go into a room, you can see, maybe you can see some people there, but maybe you won't see anything else. Or you might see something. You might see like a moth or a cockroach or something. And if there's any humans, they say, oh, go look at that, kill that, spray that fast. We don't want any of that type of life here. So, but if you go outside and you go in a forest or in a garden or to a beach or something, you're going to see a lot of life. And to me, life is all over the planet. And this is why also I tend to believe that there is life in other planets, in other solar systems. I don't have any problem with that, because I think if you look at this planet and you look at all the different environments to where there is life, you can go to sort of an Arctic area, you can go to the bottom of the sea, to like, you know, the deep, really deep trenches in the bottom of the sea, or maybe even with a volcano there, and there's life there. There's life adapted to being really deep under the water, in the dark, in the freezing cold, or in the heat. You have creatures which can live in ice and snow. You have creatures which live up in the air. You have stuff all over the entire planet. You have life which is adapted and evolved to be able to live there. Yeah, it wouldn't make any sense to me that this is the only world where that's happening. You've got all these billions and billions of other worlds and billions of solar systems, galaxies, and all this, and they've all got more planets. To say that there is nothing on any of those, that to me doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. It seems like I'm just from watching plants and really kind of interacting with them, the diversity that's available out there, it just seems like they're so versatile, and so they have such an ability to grow in places that, and these are just plants, you know, grow in places that are hard for other things to live there, but they're still alive in there, and it would make sense that we would see plants and other things on other plants because of that.
Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, I'm always seeing, if I'm out and about, you know, the plants that are growing there. And I've even been noticing, say, over here in Portugal, because we've had droughts and it's been like really dry and hot. And there are plants which I'm seeing growing here. There's one which is called Auliga. And this plant, I used to live in Tenerife in the Canary Islands, and it grows there. And it's a plant that's adapted to sort of desert conditions. And it's spreading here, I think, because, you know, it's getting hotter and drier here. And I always look to see, well, what's going on with nature, you know? And I know, like, I think quite recently David Attenborough said something about this, that species are sort of, are moving into different areas, you know, with and whatever their adaptation is, they have to, you know, go to an area that suits that. So if something is getting warmer and the creature or the plant is adapted to that, then it has to move into the warmer area. If it prefers it cold, it has to find somewhere which is cold. And for me at the moment on this planet, everything is moving about because the whole balance, I think, is sort of messed up now. And so we have, you have like freak weather happening and increasingly. And if a place is getting very hot and dry and the animals and plants can't live there anymore, then maybe they go. But then other things which can live in a hot, dry area will move in. And I think that's what's happening.
And definitely.
It always fascinates me to see plants that can grow in really hostile environments.
We're seeing a lot of changes here in I'm in the Pacific Northwest near Seattle, and I can tell you that we see a lot of different plants that are able to grow here now that have never been able to grow here before. And it's kind of concerning. I mean, humans are the only thing that really don't migrate around anymore that much. We used to, but it seems like plants are kind of ahead of the head of the change that maybe humans should listen to.
Yeah, I think humans, you know, should be listening to nature far more in general, you know.
You talked about being somewhat of an activist, and I want to get into your recent video that you told us about, and how have you been involved with activism for saving the planet, things like that? I'd really be interested in hearing about that.
Okay, well, I've got two things that I've been doing this year, but I mentioned my video that I've been promoting recently, so I'll talk about that first. But I've got a song which is called "Where Does All the Plastic Go?" To which the answer is "Into the sea, into the sea." How does it get there? Who threw it away? Was it you or was it me? And what happened with that song was I actually wrote it a few years ago as a poem. And I just left it there as a poem. But in the last year or so, I've been thinking, there's nobody else sort of saying anything. I mean, okay, that there were some sort of media stories, but there was nobody in the entertainment business. There were certainly no singer-songwriters or bands singing anything about plastic pollution. And one of my sort of all-time heroes is Neil Young. I absolutely love Neil Young's work. And Neil, as I'm sure you know, has been kept up the protest singing. He's been protesting about all sorts of stuff, you know, the Living With War album and the Monsanto years. He's naming names, you know, the Monsanto. And he's been protesting about the coal tar mining and the pipeline and all these things. And I thought, okay, well, maybe Neil will touch on this. But Neil hasn't done any song on plastic pollution. So I thought, okay, it's over to me. So I better get this poem out and convert it into a song. So I did that. And I've been recording songs with Jace Lewis at his studio in Bridgend in South Wales. And I don't know if you know who Jace is, but he's worked with a lot of very high-profile people, Brian May and Roger Taylor from Queen, Gary Numan. In fact, Jace was touring with Gary Numan earlier this year. He's got his own music out. He's had number ones in India and in Japan, and he had a BBC documentary about him made. And, you know, so I started working with Jace and, as my producer, and I thought, like, I want to get a really good production, a really good version of my song, Where Does All the Planet Go? So, Where Does All the Plastic Go? And so I recorded that, and then recently a friend of mine, Philippe, has filmed it, so we've got a video now. So I've been pushing that, and it's mostly because what happened with me was, I'm going back to 2009, and in 2009, I don't know if you followed the story or you're aware of it, but David the Rothschild, the adventurer, explorer, author, he had a plastic boat, the Plastiki, which he sailed across the ocean. And this was like a big story at the time. And I got to follow what David was doing, but I also got to be talking to him on Twitter. And I learned like so much about, I knew that there was, you know, a bad situation with plastic, but I didn't really realize how bad that situation is. And I found out about, you know, the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and the other gyres. There were five of these, you know, accumulations of plastic out there in the oceans. And I started to find out about Captain Charles Moore and about the beaches of Hawaii, which have got all this plastic, even in the sand. So it looks like sand, but it's not. It's plastic and all this terrible mess. And I thought, oh, my God, this is absolutely awful. And I have been following the destruction, which it is really, of the environment ever since, about all the plastic that keeps going out there. And when I was in Tenerife, I took a party of school children out with the science teacher just to look. We went down one beach just to look at how much plastic was on the beach. And I was explaining to them how it got there. And, you know, they were all horrified. We did like a survey to see how much plastic can we find in this square meter of this area of the beach. And you find a tremendous amount. And most of the plastic was coming down a drain, which went directly onto the beach. And you could see it. You could see plastic bottles and bags and all this junk at the bottom of the drain and on the beach below it. And I said to them that this is how the plastic gets out there. It comes down the rivers. It comes down the drains. It comes down the streams. When you get a flood after the storm, all the plastic washes, it goes down the drain. Most of this plastic is ending up in the sea. And the situation has just continued. It's got worse and worse. So I wrote that song, and that's why I've got the song out there, Where Does All the Plastic Go? And what I was going to tell you about as well was the other thing that I've been very active with this year is people campaigning to save the trees. And we're not just talking about the rainforest trees and the deforestation of the planet, which in itself is an absolutely appalling crime against nature. But we've got trees in cities throughout the UK. This is absolutely insane. I don't know, maybe you've seen some of the news, but the city of Sheffield, for example.
No, I haven't heard of it.
Okay, there's a big city in northern England, Sheffield, and something like 5,000 trees have been chopped down in the city streets by a development company, Amy PLC, with the backing of Sheffield Council. And the residents there are just really upset about this. There's people who've lived maybe in a street for all their life. They've had like a nice grove of trees outside and then, or their little park or something, and then they come out and all the trees are chopped down. And so people have been saying, well, we don't want this, you know, so we're going to try and stop all this. So there's been demonstrations going on for, I think, maybe the past 2 years in Sheffield. And there have been people taken to court. There have been arrests made. There have been increasing numbers of police brought in. It's been insane. You've had things like 30 plus police to police one tree being chopped down because there were protesters there trying to stop this. So there's all this fuss been going on, and there's various, high-profile celebrity people have got involved. Bianca Jagger has spoken out about this. Jarvis Cocker, the rock star, you know, he's spoken out about it. And this is just, I'm just talking about Sheffield, yeah, where all this madness and chopping the trees down has been going on. But as there's so many other cities in the UK, it's going on in London, it's going on in Brighton, it's going on in Liverpool, it's going on in Birmingham, Bristol, Cardiff. It's, and I was in Cardiff at the time, and that's how I got involved. Swansea, this is in Wales. There's all these cities where the trees are being chopped. And anybody...
Why do you think it's happening now versus, I mean, why aren't, you know, why is the trees being chopped down in all these cities just happening all of a sudden?
Well, I think, and I think most people that have really thought about this, it's being done for money reasons. It's being done, it makes money for a construction development company to do this because they get paid for chopping, you know, axing however many trees. And the councils are saving money. Part of the reasoning there is if you have to maintain a tree and look after a mature big tree, maybe 100 or more years old, you know, a tall tree, it's going to cost you a lot more to look after that tree than it is to get rid of it or to plant like a little sapling in its place. Because they're doing that as well. They're saying, oh, well, we're not getting rid of the trees. We're replacing them. We're putting saplings up. And unfortunately, they've been doing this and the saplings die. So, you know, it's just not working at all. And it's been mad. But I think, you know, mainly that's the reason. It's to save money.
That makes sense. I mean, on their behalf, it makes sense. But people need to realize, and it sounds like people in the UK and where you live, that they're starting to realize that this is important to them and they want to have some type of life around them when they're in a city and things like that.
Gosh, yes. And well, I was going to say, like in Cardiff, there's an area with what is called Roath Brook going through it, which is a big stream that comes out of a lake and it goes through like a housing area where there are little parks. And the people there were absolutely horrified because not only was this brook going through the park and looked very nice and everything, but there were things like kingfishers, you know, the bird breeding there. There were many fish living in the water there. The water vole, which is now an endangered species in the UK, has been seen there. And so they're saying, well, look, this is a nature reserve. This is in the city, but it's a nature reserve. We've got all these wonderful things going along here. And you want to chop down all the trees going along the side of the brook. This is wrong. And the reason that they've been given there is we're creating a flood defense scheme. Now, the people who live there say, well, we've never had any floods here. We don't need a flood defense scheme. And what's even worse about it is that the organization behind this is called Natural Resources Wales. So you think, oh, well, those are the people looking after the natural environment. But unfortunately, they're actually destroying the natural environment because it makes money for somebody. And there's a lot of people who have been speaking out about this organization. Natural Resources Wales have not been looking after the rivers either. There have been like serious pollution incidents, which Natural Resources Wales have done nothing about at all. And like thousands of fish have died. And so you could say, well, what on earth is going on here? You know, why have we got this body of people in charge of looking after the environment and making this absolutely awful hash of it all? You know, this is not on. So then on a more local level, as they say, like people are saying, well, we don't want our trees chopped down in this little park or by the brook. We don't want to see all this destroyed. So people have been getting out there in the street. People have been, you know, doing the usual thing, they're doing a demonstration, holding up banners, making signs, maybe putting things all around a tree, maybe making a sign, save me, or I am, and giving a name to the tree. I'm just thinking, some of the trees, yeah, this is right, like in Sheffield, some of the trees there got known for their names. One, the Duchess Lime, is one of the threatened trees in Sheffield. Unfortunately, she's been chopped now.
But
she got like a name, and it gives it far more of a sort of a talking point, and it makes it far more colourful for people to be thinking, you know, oh, we don't want Duchess Lime being destroyed, you know.
Right. And they put a name to it, and then it relates to them. They believe it's a real live being now versus just a tree.
And so anyway, there's been all this going on, and I got involved with the Cardiff Roast Brook protest, and I went along there, And I'm known for doing, as well as my own songs, I do some cover songs. And the cover song that I'm best known for doing is Stand By Me. And I did this on Britain's Got Talent last year. I was on that show. And anyway, I went along to the tree protest, and I changed the lyric to Stand By Tree instead of Stand By Me. And they liked that. And I've also got a song called Kingfisher, and I did that, and it sort of fits with Kingfishers there. And somebody from the group said, was it okay if they made a poster out of me? I said, yeah, sure. So they made a poster of me with, you know, Your Trees Need You. And this went out, you know, on the social media all over the place. And that sort of established me, if you like, as a poster boy for the Save the Trees movement.
Neat.
And then something came out of that. There's a guy called Jonathan Downs, and he runs a thing called the Gonzo Weekly. And he also does a lot of other things, but the one thing he does do is the Gonzo Weekly. And he wanted me to interview me for that. And I'm the cover star of one of his issues of the Gonzo Weekly.
Awesome. Yeah, I think I saw that on your blog or something.
Okay, and that's all about the tree protests. So this year I've become very active in, you know, trying to save the trees, trying to stop the plastic pollution. And I think that's how I'm going to be continuing. You know, my focus has gone to, let's do something about the environment, you know. And I say it's very much a people thing, because it's the people are getting out there. People are saying, we don't want all this. We don't want all this plastic in our oceans. We don't want all our trees chopped down. You know, we want a nice environment.
Yeah, definitely. I do. I know I do, and my family does. So, well, I appreciate everything you do, Steve. And it sounds like you're making big movements in the protect the environment and also protect the planet kind of way. So I appreciate that for you doing that.
Well, thank you, Lee. You know, I think it's, for me, it's something that sort of, I've used the word naturally, it comes naturally to me. Because, you know, for me, I've been caring about nature all my life. And it's just like, I've had enough. You know, I don't want to see all this mess being made of everything, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
And that's what I think is great, is that I can see so many other people coming together on that. It's a bit like the John Lennon saying, like, power to the people. I think this is what it's coming to, that the people are coming together to say, we've had enough. We don't want our oceans wrecked. We don't want, and they are doing that. There's more people going out to clean up the beaches. There are people picking up like litter as they go out. People doing jogging. There's even a term for it. I can't think of what it is, but you might have seen it. But there are people going jogging and collecting like litter as they're doing that. And so there's more and more people trying to clean up their environment and to change their life. There's also people making lots of life changes. There's a lot of people becoming vegan now, and people becoming raw foodists, and all sorts of major life changes, trying to do something about their own health, the health of the planet. And I think that's really what it's come to.
Well, it makes sense. You know, this is the planet that we live on, and this is what we got to take care of. Otherwise, we're not going to have a place to live anymore, along with plants and animals and things like that. So I totally agree with you on that. And hopefully more people listen to your story and the importance behind it, and they make changes in their lifestyle. Little changes can make big impacts too. So we'll definitely go out and watch your video, and I'll make sure to share that around as well. But Steve, we're kind of running out on time here, but I wanted to give you one last opportunity to shout out to your different websites and media outlets that people can go to in order to follow up on your research, as well as your books, things like that. So what are the important websites and media outlets that you have that you can share?
Okay. Well, I think Twitter is a very important one. And at Twitter, my tag there is at Bard of Ely. But as I said, I am known as the Bard of Ely, BARDOFELY, at Bard of Ely. I'm on Facebook.
Your blog as well, all right?
A blog, that's right. I've got a Green Bard blog.
You're also published with Moon Books, I believe.
Yes, I'm just looking at the page now. On Moon Books, which is www.moon-books.net/authors/Steve-Andrews. And on there, you'll find a bio. You'll find a picture of me, actually, when I was on Britain's Got Talent. And you will find my three books with Moon Books, including my book, which is coming out next year, Herbs of the Southern Shaman. So that's that. And Facebook, my main page there is facebook.com/Steve Andrews, a.k.a. Bard of Ely.
Okay. Well, I'll make sure to put all the links in with the article that we will publish along with this this podcast release. And so everyone can go to the website and make sure to find information there for your books as well as all your social media outlets.
Well, thank you so much, Lee. This is really helpful, and it's been a real pleasure being on your show tonight.
Yeah, thanks for spending time with us, Steve. And I'll make sure to go out and read one of your books and hopefully learn some interesting information about plants, herbs, and shamanism all in one.
This episode of Cosmic Echo was brought to you by Moon Books. If you enjoyed this episode of Cosmic Echo and would like to learn more about Steve and his work, you can go to our website at taleeaters.com/CE podcast, and there you can click on links that will take you to his work as well as his books. Additionally, if you would like to support this podcast, you can do so through our Patreon page, located at the same website. We look forward to bringing you additional episodes in the near future, but until then, happy dreaming.